For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is June the 11th. We are in Shmuel Beis. This will be a little bit of a shorter shiur than usual. Shmuel Beis, we're in Perek Aleph, the first chapter. And we are up to Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17, where we are going to have David's kina, David's lamentation for the loss of Shaul and Yehonah's son. Not a very long kina. It'll take us to the end of the chapter. It's only 11 verses. It's power packed. There's a lot in here.
Which is bizarre.
Well, we'll see. Let's go through it. Now we will try our best to cover as much of it as we can. We'll go through the whole thing, but there's a lot of depth, and we're going to try our best to cover as much of that depth as we can. Shmuel Beis, yeah, Shmuel Beis, Perek Aleph. Pasuk Yud Zayin says, "Vayekonein David esakina hazos." David lamented this lamentation. Al Shaul val Yehonasan no on Shaul and on Yehonasan his son. Vayomer, and he said, "Lilamed bnei Yehuda kashes," to teach the children of Yehuda the bow, which means a bow and arrow, as Rashi explains. Now that Shaul and Yehonasan have been killed, the children of Yehuda need to learn how to use the bow and arrow. Now they need to become better warriors, because we've lost the power of Shaul and Yehonasan. Hinech Suval Sefer HaYashar, behold, it is written on the Sefer HaYashar, on, literally that means the book of the straight ones. There is a discussion in the Gemara what book this is referring to, and what is it written over there. So we'll discuss this after we read the entire thing. We'll come back to this and discuss what is the Sefer HaYashar, the book of the straight ones, and what exactly it means that this is written, previously been written over there. Hatzvi Yisrael Alba Mosecha Chalol. The Yisrael, meaning the Jewish people, were established. The Jews were established. They were in their power. They were well situated in their power. And yet Chalol, they were shot down. They were cut down. Eich naflu giborim. How did the strong ones fall? How could they have fallen? Al tagidu v'gas, don't talk about this in Gas, which is the city of the Plishtim. Al tevasu b'chutzos Ashkelon, don't tell the news in the streets of Ashkelon, also a city of the Plishtim. Pentismachna benos Plishtim, lest the daughters of the Plishtim should be happy. Pentalozna benos ha'arelim, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised ones, the Plishtim, should rejoice. Harei v'gilboa, the mountains in Gilboa, which is where Shaul was killed, the mountains in Gilboa, al tal v'al matar aleichem, it should not, there should be no dew, there should be no rain upon you. He's cursing the mountains upon which Shaul fell. Usei trumos, and there should be no fields of trumos that would produce truma, which means the tithes. There shouldn't be any enough food to produce that. Hisham nigal magin giborim, because there the shield of the strong ones was nigal. Nigal means it rejected. It rejected, as Rashi explains, we'll see the rest of the verse in a moment, the way, what they would do is they would take a leather shield and smear it with oil. And that way, if a sword would be struck against the shield, the sword would slide off.
Right.
That's what they would do. But the shield of the strong ones rejected its oil, as if there was no oil on the shield, so it could not stop the blow of the sword. Magen Shaul b'li Mashiach b'shamen. The sword of Shaul did not have its anointment of oil. Midam chalalim, from the blood of the corpses. Mechelev giborim, from the best of the strong ones. Keshes Yehonasan lo nasogachor. The bow of Yehonasan would never be turned back, meaning the bow of Yehonasan would never be turned back from taking the blood of the corpses of the enemies and striking down all of the strong ones. The cherub Shaul also shuvrekam, and the sword of Shaul never came back empty-handed. And yet over here they were killed. Shaul v'Yehonah son, Shaul and Yehonah son, ha'ne'ehavim v'ha'ne'imim v'chayehem, the ones who were beloved and cherished during their lifetimes, uv'mosam lo nifradu, and in their deaths they have not been separated. You recognize this quote as because we say it on Shabbos in Avarachamim. Minisharim kalu, from eagles they were swifter to serve Hashem. Me arayos gaveru, from lions they were stronger to serve Hashem. Benos Yisrael el Shaul bechena, daughters of Israel, for Shaul you should cry. Hamabishkem shani imadonim, that he clothed you. Shani is silk or beautiful clothing, and with adonim, adonim are like what's that?
Jewels.
That's right. Hamale adi zahav al bushchen, that would put golden jewelry on your clothing. You should cry for Shaul. He used to adorn you in beauty, and now he's gone. Ech naflu giborim, how could the strong ones have fallen? Besel chamil chama, in the middle of the war. Now he's going to switch to exclusively about Yehonasan. Yehonasan, abba masecha chalol, Yehonasan, on your heights you fell, you were killed. Tzar li alecha, achi Yehonasan, it pains me about you, my brother Yehonasan. Na'am toli ma'od, you were very precious to me. Nifla'asa ahavas chalim, ahavas nashim, my love for you was greater than the love for women. A natural love that a man would have for a woman, my love for you was greater. Ech naflu giborim, how could the strong ones have fallen? Vayovdu klei milchama, and the vessels of war have been lost. The Jews, the vessels of war for the Jewish people, meaning Shaul and Yehonasan, they were the vessels of that way we were able to make war. They are now gone. That is David's kina. That's his lamentation for Shaul and Yehonasan. He was obviously crying while saying this kina. You can tell that it's a heartfelt and emotional kina, and it's recorded here. Now let's go back to the beginning of this kina, which starts in Yud-Zayin 17, and let's go through it carefully with some of the points that we made and adding some points as well. So David says a lamentation for Shaul and for Yehonasan his son, for two of them. But we're going to see that certain parts are about both, certain parts are about Shaul, and certain parts are about Yehonasan. Vayomer, and he said, Pasuk Yud-Ches, verse 18, Lulamed b'nei Yehuda kashas. Now the b'nei Yehuda, now the those of the tribe of Yehuda need to learn how to use the bow. Hineich suva al sefer hayashar. This is written in the sefer hayashar, in the book of the straight. The Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah says, what is the sefer hayashar? What is this book of the straight? And there are three opinions. One opinion is that it is sefer Bereishis. That would be the book of creation. And in that book, it talks about the Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, our patriarchs, who are considered to be the Yesharim, the straight ones. And that's why it's called the Book of the Straight. Another suggestion is that it's Sefer Dvarim. That would be Deuteronomy. And the reason why Dvarim would be referred to as Sefer HaYashar is because in the Book of Dvarim is a pasuk, is a verse that says, V'asisa hayashar v'hatov, you should do what is straight and good in the eyes of Hashem. So perhaps it's referring to Dvarim. And there is a third opinion that it is referring to Sefer Shoftim, the book of Judges, which is not even Torah, it would be in the prophets. And the reason why we're referring to the book of Judges of Shoftim is because there it says that there was no king in Sefer Shoftim. Ish hayashar be'enav yaseh, each man did what was straight in his own eyes. And so, therefore, it might be referred to as Sefer HaYashar. Now, all three opinions show that there is an allusion in these three books to to making war with the bow, using a bow and arrow to make war, and referring to the tribe of Yehuda. In Sefer Bereishis, there is a pasuk that Yaakov Avinu says about Yehuda, that Yadcha ba'oref oivecha, your hand will be at the back of the neck of your enemy. The oref is the back of the neck. It conjures up the image of the powerful warriors of Yehuda grabbing hold of the necks of their enemies and forcing them to do what they want them to do. So if you drop the word enemy, it says your hand, Yadcha Ba'oref, is at the back of the neck, or corresponding to the back of the neck. As the Gemara says, what type of warfare requires your hand to correspond to the back of your neck? Well, why would your hand be up near your face, corresponding to the back of your neck?
So
the Gemara says the bow and arrow would require that. A sword does not require that. A sword is held over your head or to the side or whatever it is, but the bow and arrow, it is held over here because you need to aim.
That's right.
Next to your face, you need to be aiming the bow and arrow. That's one explanation. In Sefer Devarim, it says when Moshe Rabbeinu is giving a bracha to Yehuda, it says Yadav Rav Lo. Yadav Rav Lo. His hands, plural, will be many for him, or powerful for him. Yadav, his hands. The Gemara says, what type of warfare requires two hands? Where the sword only requires one hand. What type of warfare requires two hands? That would be the bow, which requires two hands. And then finally, in Shoftim, it says, there's a verse in Shoftim, in Perek Gimel, in the third chapter of Shoftim, referring to the tribe of Yehuda, that says war needs to be taught. And the Gemara says, what type of warfare needs to be taught? Do you need to be trained in? More so than just regular warfare, that would be the bow and arrow, which requires training. You have to learn how to aim and shoot the bow and arrow properly. So the Gemara, therefore, is distinguishing a bow and arrow from a sword in three ways. One, the hand is placed up near one's face, because one needs to shoot to aim. Two is that you need two hands to do it. And three is that it needs practice, needs to be trained and taught, rather than using a sword. Now, in understanding this a little bit further, we should understand that we think that there's many different types of weapons that one could use in war. There are guns, and there are swords, and there are tanks, and there are planes, and there are bombs, and there are you name it. There's all kinds of, there are grenades, there are whatever you want. There's all kinds of stuff. There's biological, there's chemical, there's all kinds of weapons that could be used. But from the Torah's perspective, there are only two types of warfare. Every type of warfare falls into one of two categories. One category is the sword, the other category is the bow and arrow. Every single type of warfare. There's no modern method that is different than those two things. The sword refers to any type of warfare which uses only the power of a person's body. That means hand-to-hand combat. It means using, my hand is not sharp, so I have a sword that is sharp, but it is ultimately being driven with the force of my hand. I could stand far away, take a rock, and throw it. All it's using is the force of my arm. I'm not as strong as a rock is. The rock is more, is stronger than my hand, but it is the forces involved are me, only the person. My fist, a rock, a sword, it's all the same thing. It's my foot, it's all a kick, it's all the same, that just me being involved in this war. I may have something which is a weapon in my hand, and a weapon can be worn not only in the hand, it can be worn on the foot, it can be worn on whatever, but the force that is being used to propel the weapon is me. A bow and arrow introduces another force that propels the weapon. Today, we would call that gunpowder. Mm-hmm. There's another force that propels the weapon. A bomb is nothing other than a lot of stuff that's packed together, which is then exploded using an explosive force that's a propellant that pushes out all whatever is being done, and it causes great harm. When the harm or the force is delivered by a different force other than the body, that is the bow and arrow. We have, through technology, we have much more sophisticated bows and arrows today than they used to have. But ultimately, the bow and arrow is simply a
a weapon that is using a propelled force other than coming from a human body.
Now, when you don't have gunpowder, you don't have technology, then the truth is a bow and arrow is a form of technology. But the reason why a bow and arrow is able to do that is a bow is a rigid piece of something, whether it's wood or something else, but it's something rigid, which can be bent, and now it is in tension because it's bent, so there's tension there. And then I can fit an arrow on a string, which is now affixed, and there's strong tension. When I let go, that that bow snaps into place, causing a release of the tension, which propels the arrow forward. So I'm creating a propellant that is not me. I'm the one who created the propellant, but it is working through a power that is not mine. I've created a technological advantage in that now it snaps and sends the projectile forward. That has been perfected in other ways. Not perfected when you perfect war, but that has been advanced in other ways, using gunpowder, using other types of things which propels things forward. But the item that is being, the weapon, is being moved forward through a force other than me. That is why two hands are necessary. Because if you're only using one hand, you can't create tension. Because in order to create tension, you need to have the tension and then release it. There's got to be first the tension and then it has to be released. If you don't hold the tension, then you never have it in the first place. You've got to be able to hold it, at least for a second, and then release it. That's what creates tension. So you need two hands to do that. You can't do that with one hand. Now you can improvise. You could tie something to something else and then pull back and let go. And there you've created with one hand. But you need another item to hold the other side in order to create tension. A slingshot as well requires the two hands. And there has to be aimed, which is why the hand has to be up here, because you've got to be able to aim something that is being shot over a long distance. If you don't aim, you're going to miss. And it needs to be taught, it needs to be studied, it needs to be practiced, otherwise it's not good. It's going to be ineffective. So those are the differences between the bow and arrow and the sword. Now that Shaul and Jehonathan have been killed, the Bnei Yehuda need to learn to use the bow and arrow. In other words, as long as Shaul and Jehonathan were alive, we didn't need the technology. It wasn't necessary. All we needed was the strength of Shaul and Jehonathan to wage war. They didn't need the technology, although we'll see in a moment a little bit of a question on this. But what is being said over here is, it wasn't necessary. You didn't have to propel the projectile using any force but the human being. Because Shaul and Jehonathan, they were strong enough. It wasn't necessary. But now that they have been removed, they have been killed, and now who's taking over? David is taking over. And David is taking over as the king, and the Bnei Yehuda henceforth are going to be the leaders of the wars. They need to learn how to use the keshes. They need to learn how to use the bow. And this is already foretold in the Sefer HaYashar that the Bnei Yehuda will be excellent warriors using the keshes. But it's a technology that wasn't needed by Shaul. Shaul didn't need the technology. Shaul was able to wage war with the sword. He didn't need this additional technology. The psukim continue that in their greatest heights, in their greatest strength, they were still cut down and killed. And don't say this in front of the plishtim. That's a lamentation that now they're going to be happy. In Pasuk Chavala, verse 21, David curses the mountains of Gilboa because that is where they fell. And mention is made of the shield of Shaul. Now here's a fascinating thing. As we mentioned, they used to smear the shield with oil, and that would cause the sword or whatever else is shot at it to slide off. And it's as if Shaul's sword rejected the oil, and therefore it wasn't able to stop the blow, and they were cut down. But notice the words at the end of the pasuk: "Magen Shaul, the sword of Shaul, beli Mashiach Bashamen. Bashamen. It was without being anointed with oil. It is not coincidental to use the phrase Beli Mashiach without being anointed. What is David's refrain every time somebody wants to kill Shaul? What does he say? He's the Mashiach Hashem. He's the anointed one of Hashem. How dare anybody raise their hand against the anointed one of Hashem? And when the Ger Amaleki does so, David kills the Ger Amaleki for having raised his hand against the Mashiach Hashem. He says that it was as if Shaul was missing the Mashiach Bashamen, the being anointed with oil, as if it was removed from Shaul. Yes.
But Shaul was told by Shmuel that he died.
Yes.
And a king is always anointed Shem HaMishra.
No, not always.
Not always.
Not always. Not always. No. The new king is the new line is. That's true. But not all kings are anointed.
But Shaul was anointed the Shem.
He was. That's what David is saying. If that was removed.
Mm-hmm.
Now the next pasuk is a curiosity. Pasuk Chavez verse 22 says that from the blood of corpses and the best of the strong ones. Yonasan's keshes, Yonasan's bow, would never be turned away, and the sword of Shaul would not return empty. So here we have a reference to a bow and Yonasan. It seemed from the beginning of this kina, of the lamentation, it seemed that the bow was not needed by Shaul and Yonasan. Rather that now that they're gone, the Bnei Yehuda need to learn how to use this technology. But here we have reference to Yonasan's keshes never being turned back. Now the truth is that in the battle before, where we saw Yonasan fighting, we never saw him use a keshes. It was always with a sword that he waged war. And yet David makes reference to Yonasan's bow. When, in Shmuel Aleph, did we have a case of Yonasan and a bow? Okay, when David was in hiding and Yonasan was going to give him the sign whether he should leave or go, Yonasan devises the plan, and the plan is using a bow and arrow. That's what he's using. I'm going to shoot the bow and arrow, I shoot the arrows, and depending where they go, that's going to determine what the story is. We described in great detail at the time what exactly the sign was. It is not a coincidence that Yonasan chose the bow and arrow as the sign for David. Because the Bnei Yehuda are known for their proficiency with the bow and arrow, as it is already foretold in the Sefer Hayasha, whether it is Bracious or Devarim or Shoftim, it is already foretold that the Bnei Yehuda's ability to wage war is with the bow and arrow. Yonasan, who is sending a sign to David, chooses the bow and arrow as the sign. He could have chosen a sign that involved a sword, which would have represented Shaul and not David. But Yonasan chose, or would have represented himself. Yonasan chose the bow and arrow, which is a representation of David, not of Yonasan. That speaks to Yonasan's deep love, admiration, and respect for David. And how Yonasan several times pledges his allegiance to David, even though he's really the heir apparent to Shaul, but he recognizes that David is really to be the king, and he pledges his allegiance to David. And Yonasan is willing to change from the sword to the bow in deference to David. And David here makes reference to Yonasan's bow, even though really that is the form, that is the weapon of David more than the weapon of Yonasan. In Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23, we have Shaul and Yonasan, and we have that famous quote that are loved and cherished in their lifetimes and in their deaths have not been separated, meaning separated from us or separated from each other. They were swifter than eagles, more powerful than lions to serve Hashem. Make no mistake, for all of what happened with Shaul, as we've said over and over and over again, Shaul is still the great tzaddik. Shaul is still in Olam Haba next to Shmuel. And then in Chafdala 24, the daughters of Yisrael to Shaul cry. David says, cry for Shaul, all the daughters of the Bnei Yisrael. Why? Shaul clothed you in beautiful clothing and gems and precious stones, and he put golden jewelry on your clothing. The Gemara says this has two meanings, this pasuk. Number one, when the men would go to war, Shaul would make sure that all families, all the women who were at home while the men were at war, were fed and taken care of. That all wages that were lost because men were going to war were paid to the women at home. This was an innovation that had not been the case previously. There was no such thing as somebody taking care of the soldiers' families when they were to war, because the purpose of war was to protect everybody. So what do you mean? Yeah, of course you have to drop everything and go to war. There was no feeling that, no need to support those at home, because everybody, I mean, if the men wouldn't go to war, the place would be destroyed. So of course you've got to give up. But Shaul felt the need to care for the wives of the men who went to war. And therefore, he made sure they did not become impoverished through war, and as a result, they remained beautiful, and therefore they were able to wear their jewelry, and they were able to remain beautiful. The Gemara, the Mishnah in Nedarim says that Rabbi Yishmael was once, there was a man who swore that he would not marry his niece. It was very common practice to marry a niece, and the man had been read a shidduch to his niece, and he swore he would not marry her because she was ugly. They brought her into Rabbi Yishmael's house, and Rabbi Yishmael told his attendants, the women in his house, to take care of this girl, and they bathed her and clothed her and gave her what to eat, etc. And then she emerged looking beautiful. And then they brought her before the uncle, and Rabbi Yishmael said to him, young man, did you swear not to marry this woman? And he said, no, sir. And he removed the oath. He was able to be matur the nether, to annul the vow, and they were able to marry. At which point Rabbi Yishmael cried, and he said, the Jewish daughters are all beautiful, but poverty makes them ugly. Because when people are poor, it's very hard to remain beautiful. And then the Gemara says over there that Shaul, here, that's what David is saying to the girls. David is saying to the girls, you remained beautiful because Shaul made sure you never became impoverished. Cry over his loss. He was a big loss to all of you. That's one explanation that the Gemara says. The other explanation in the Gemara, the Yerushalmi, says that this is actually not referring to girls at all. It's referring to the beautiful ones of the Jewish people. In other words, the Sanhedrin, the Talmidei Chachamim. That Shaul would make sure that the Talmidei Chachamim, that the sages, had what to eat. Since they spent their time studying, they didn't have a livelihood necessarily, and he would make sure that they did not become impoverished, that they had what to eat. And the reference to the gold is that when Shaul would hear the Torah from the words of the sages, he would praise them and be excited over their words of Torah. And that he treated it like gold. He treated the Torah that they said like gold. So David here is making reference to both points, that he took care of the daughters of Israel, number one, and number two, he took care of the sages as well.
It says, who clothed you in scarlet?
Shani, that is the correct translation. I'm sorry, I translated it wrong. I think just because it's a beautiful, a beautiful clothing. How could the next question is, how could the great ones have fallen, the strong ones have fallen in the war? And now David switches. That pasuk, Chafdala 24, was about Shaul. Now he switches to Yohanan, who we already know about David and Yonasan's great love for each other. He makes reference of Yonasan falling even in his greatness. And he says, I have terrible pain over my brother Yohanan. You were very precious to me, and my love to you exceeded the love for women. And then he ends off, how could the great ones, the strong ones, have fallen, and we've lost the vessels of war? In this very heartfelt kina, this lamentation that David has for Shaul. So this comes on the heels, you'll recall, that back in Pasuk Yud Beis 12, which is what we did last time, it says that they said eulogies, vayispedu, vayivku, they cried, vayatsumu ad ha'erev, and they fasted until nightfall. When they heard of the deaths of Shaul and Yonah's son, and how the people were killed, they eulogized, they cried, and they fasted until nightfall. And now David says this heartfelt kina, this lamentation. Now we know that Shaul is a complex character. It's very difficult. We know how unbelievable he was, that he was the most qualified person in all of Klal Yisrael to be the king. We know that he had never sinned before he became king. We know that while he was king, he did some incredible things. Here we're only now finding out about some things which we didn't know about. We didn't know he took care of the girls. We didn't know that he took care of the sages. We didn't know that he was so excited over the Torah the sages said. We're finding that out about him now. There were some wonderful things that Shaul did. We know that he was also instrumental in making sure the Jewish people were careful with the laws of Shechita, of ritual slaughter. We had that before, that he made sure that was done properly. We have several things that Shaul, we know about his tznius, his modesty, the great modesty of Shaul that exceeded everybody else's. We know all these great things. We also know that at the end of his life, Shaul was beset by problems, primarily because of his sins that he did do. One was that he disobeyed Shmuel to bring the sacrifice too early. Another was that he did not kill out Amalek properly. And then one thing led to another, and ultimately he was the one who commanded that the city of Nov, the Kohanim, be killed, which was a terrible, terrible sin. And we know that things went wrong. But at the same time, we also know, and then there's the end also where he conjured up Shmuel. But at the end, we know that Shmuel says, tomorrow you're with me. And the Gemara says, "Imi b'mechitzasi, you're with me in my portion in the world to come." That's where you, Shaul, are. That Shaul never really fell. He did some things that weren't 100% appropriate. He did teshuva at the end of his life when he knew that Hashem was going to punish him. He did not stop him or his sons from going out to war, knowing that Hashem was going to punish him. He accepted the din. He accepted the judgment of Hashem willingly, knowing that it was the right thing to do, and he went out to war. David, we also know, has insisted over and over and over again that you may not kill Shaul because he is the Mashiach Hashem. David would not have said that if he believed that Shaul lost the right to be the Mashiach Hashem. Had Shaul acted in a manner that would have warranted removing him from his post as king, then David would never have prevented people from killing him. If Shaul's existence as king was hurting the Jewish people or creating a Chilul Hashem, then David would not have stopped people from killing Shaul. But David held up until the very end that Shaul was still the right man for the job, was ultimately good for the people, not bad for the people. And it would have been best had there been a seamless transition from Shaul to David. Unfortunately, they didn't merit it. We didn't merit it. We weren't Zocha. We didn't merit that there would be a seamless transition from Shaul and Yonasan to David. Instead, it's a traumatic transition with the deaths of Shaul and Yonasan. But the fascinating thing is this. We're going to learn, Mitzvah Hashem, all of Shmuel Beis. It'll take us some time. Towards the end of Shmuel Beis, you can hold the place over here. Towards the end, almost the very end of Shmuel Beis, which is towards the end of David's life and David's reign, a long reign of 40 years that David has. Towards the end, in Perek Chaf Aleph, chapter 21, all the way at the end, Perek Chaf Aleph, chapter 21.
First one.
Chaf Aleph Aleph, yeah. 21:1. Vayehi Rav b'mei David shalosh shanim shana acharei shana. There was a famine in the days of David. For three years, 1 year after the next, meaning 3 years in succession of famine. So that was highly unusual. David understood it was a punishment for something. Vayevakesh David et pnei Hashem. So David asked Hashem, Why did this happen? Vayomer Hashem. Hashem said, El Shaul Vel Beis Hadamim. It is about Shaul and about the, literally, the house of blood, which means the murders. Ala Sher Hamis Es HaGivonim, that he, Shaul, killed the Givonim. Who were the Givonim? The Givonim were those who tricked Yehoshua, who pretended to be non-Jews who came from outside of Eretz Yisrael. They were really Canaanim. They were really those who were from Canaan, from inside Eretz Yisrael, which means there was a commandment to kill them out, because any Canaani that didn't leave or convert, Yehoshua was commanded to kill. And they tricked Yehoshua into making him believe that they were from out of Eretz Yisrael. And Yehoshua swore to them that he would not kill them. Then he discovered they really were Canaanim. And so there was a problem. What do you do with them? He can't kill them anymore because he swore. But on the other hand, they weren't allowed to become part of the Jewish people, or they weren't allowed to remain alive. So Yehoshua made them as water drawers and firewood bearers for the Kohanim. That's what he did. He gave them menial tasks that they would become their job. They were not able to be hold other professions in Eretz Yisrael. They didn't have fields or their crops. Their job was to bring water and wood for the Kohanim. And that was their livelihood, which was a menial task, which would prevent them from becoming part of the broader Jewish nation. So that was what they did. When Shaul had the city of Nov killed out, a consequence was that the Givonim lost their livelihood, because there was no city of Kohanim anymore to provide firewood and water for. And the Givonim ended up having a very, very difficult time. So one of the reasons why the 3-year famine took place is because the Givonim lost their livelihood and no one realized it, no one took care of them. That's one of the reasons. And David is going to have to take steps over here to appease the Givonim. And in appeasing the Givonim, it's going to find expression in some executions of some of the descendants of Shaul to make up for what happened to the Givonim. And it will also result in the cruelty of the Givonim showing its ugly face, and David therefore making a decree against the Givonim. This we will learn about Mirz Hashem when we get there in Shmuel Beis. But that's not all the pasuk says. It says that the reasons for the famine were for Shaul and for the murders that he killed the Givonim. He didn't actually kill the Givonim, but the Givonim lost their livelihood, which is like killing them. But what does it mean about Shaul? So the Gemara says, our sages tell us, and Rashi quotes it over here, that there were two reasons for the famine. Number two was because of what happened to the Givonim. Number one was, and I'll read you what Rashi says, Alavon Shaul, on the sin that had to do with Shaul, Shenik bar Pisom, that he was buried suddenly, Uvehe Chaveh, and in secret. Remember that at the end of Shmuel Aleph, he was hung up on the wall outside of the city in the Plishtim, and remember the people of Yabesh Gilad, the heroic people, came in the middle of the night. They cut down his body and they brought it back and buried him properly. Sheganvuhu anshe Yavesh Gilad, that the people of Yavesh Gilad stole his body away, the kavruhu, and they buried him, but they did it secretly. Velo nispeid lefi kavodo, and he was not eulogized with the proper honor. Because Shaul was not eulogized properly, a 3-year famine fell upon the Jewish people. And people starved to death. People died. A 3-year famine doesn't mean it was just like, oh, it was hard to find food. It means people starved to death. Why? Because Shaul was not eulogized properly. You see the incredible responsibility there is to say a proper hesped, a proper eulogy of an Adam Gadol, of a great man. If this is a little bit frightening, it should be. When a great person passes away,
God forbid, it is incumbent, it is a responsibility to eulogize him properly. And despite the fact that we read that back in Perek Aleph, that we read that David eulogized and cried and fasted for the loss of Shaul, and then he says this heartfelt kina, this heartfelt lamentation, nevertheless, it was not enough. And therefore, towards the end of David's reign, a 3-year famine falls upon the people. Even though the other reason for the famine was Shaul's fault. It's an unbelievable thing. There's two reasons for the famine. The second reason is Shaul's to blame because of the loss of Nov, and the Givonim had no livelihood. So Shaul caused that problem. Nevertheless, the other reason for the famine is because they didn't eulogize Shaul properly. There was an expectation, evidently, that after things, they couldn't do it at the time when they got him off the wall because the Plishtim were going to attack. They couldn't do that. But later, once David had gained control of the land and the Plishtim were and all the enemies were put down, there should have been a mass eulogy for the loss of Shaul. And it didn't happen, and therefore there was a famine. It's an unbelievable thing. Just to hit home the point, no one should walk away from Shmuel Aleph with any inkling of a thought that Shaul was anything less than the great tzaddik that he was. Despite everything we learned, and that's why every time we learn something negative about him, I try to tell you that you've got to accept the fact that he's being held to a very high standard. And although he's criticized, we're talking about a man who is greater than anybody we've ever met in our entire lives, and anybody who's been alive for the past several thousand years. We're talking about one of the greatest people who ever walked the face of the earth in Shaul. And we should never forget that, to the point that Hashem took offense that he was not eulogized properly after all this that we see over here. An amazing, amazing thing about Shaul. He's a very complex character, and he's a tragic, tragic figure. That's who Shaul is. And we begin Shmuel Beis with this reminder of not to forget who Shaul was as we now move on to David. Mr. Hashem will continue that next week.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.